Okay, so we're back. And the first thing that I have to tell you is that during this last week, I had a couple of emails back and forth over what appeared to be confusion about what was happening in verses 16 and 17. And I admit it was confusing, especially since it's so complicated. And so I rewrote the piece on 16 and 17, and I asked Mark to post it to the additional materials under the title Romans 1:17, which is now available to you with a download from the materials. And then at 4 o'clock this morning, I woke up thinking about this stuff and I thought, that's not right. I have to go back and write it again, which I did this morning at 4 o'clock. And now I have to send that to Mark and have him update the one that's in your additional material so that you get the new version instead of the old version. So don't download the one that's there on 1:17 yet until I send off the new one to Mark. There's only one sentence that I want to change, but it's an important sentence. And therefore, I want you to wait until he gets the new piece before you download the materials. But I want to talk about 16 and 17 because I don't want it to be confusing. Because when we start marching down the rest of this path through this letter, this is going to be the foundation of everything. And the issue is about the interpretation of Habakkuk 2:4. So let me just quickly look at the article that I wrote and say, okay, here's what I want to point out. And that is when we start looking at what happens in Habakkuk 2:4, I wrote this up for you so you can download it later. You don't have to worry about it right now. I gave you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 other places that I've written about this verse where you can look at the development of the verse. But what I wanted to point out is we said in our discussion that the usual translation, the just shall live by faith, really isn't the way that the Hebrew actually functions. Okay? And what I suggested is that we needed to change the translation based on Paul's view of this issue about righteousness and the law. Okay? And so you'll see this in the document that you're going to download. But what I said is we should look at it like this. If we go to the Hebrew text, we want to look at it so that it reads the following. The tzaddik, which is the one who conforms to the ethical and moral expectations of the day, is the tzaddik by his emunah shall live. So we would translate that, the righteous by his faith shall live. But the two critical words, tzaddikah, which is the righteous, and emunah, which is the word from which we get amen, the word for truth, are really, really important Hebrew words that Paul obviously was aware of. But when you translate them into Greek, and especially in our modern sense, we don't understand what they actually say. So we read the verse as though the righteous means somebody who's pure in heart. But in fact, tzaddikah in Hebrew means literally someone who conforms his behavior to the expected standards of the community. Right? So tzaddikah has nothing to do with my inner purity or holiness. It has everything to do with my behavior in terms of what is expected of me in the community that I'm in. Right? Which for Paul is the messianic Jewish community. So what is the expected behavior? Mosaic obedience to the Mosaic Torah, right? That's the only thing it can mean. So if you go to Habakkuk and you read the verse according to Hebrew, it would say, the one who conforms his behavior to the ethical and moral standards of the Mosaic Code, that one, right? By his, and then we have emunah, by his, does emunah mean truth? No, it means reliability, by his constancy, by his continuous commitment to. Okay? That person shall live. Now that's really different than the just shall live by faith, because the just shall live by faith means it sounds like I have to have faith in order to be justified so that I can live. But that's not what the verse is saying in Habakkuk, and I don't believe that's what Paul is saying. What Paul is saying is, if you conform yourself to the Mosaic Code and you live according to the expectations of the moral and ethical commitments of that code, because and you do that by showing your constancy and reliability, then you will live. Right? You see how different it is? Okay, anyway, if you didn't get all that, You'll have it in the download with the Hebrew, with the explanations, with all that kind of stuff, so that we can clarify exactly what it is that Paul means when he talks about, you know, using Habakkuk 2:4 as the foundation verse for his letter. And why is that important? Because you can see that if you read the Hebrew that way, and if that's the proper way that Paul understands it, then there is absolutely no possibility that the law is ever divorced from what he's trying to say. Because what he's saying is that, and I'll make one other point, what he's saying is that the law is foundational to what it means to be tzedakah, what it means to be righteous. Okay? Now, another point. And this comes from, I mentioned this book that I'm reading. Well, I'm actually reading articles in this book, and I mention it again so that you can get the title. The name of the book is, it's a collection of essays, and it's called The Believer and the Modern Study of the Bible. Okay? Now, you can download that book for free from a source called Academia. Now, I don't know if you're not registered as an academic or if you're a professor someplace. I don't know if it's free, but you can try, right? Because this book has been granted through a Jewish organization to be made public so that you can download the thing. So I'm pretty sure that you can download it, okay? And in that book is it's 100 pages of articles. It's a fabulous collection. And in that book is an incredible collection, or incredible article. And the article is called, it's about 414, page 414 or something. It's called Discrepancies Between Laws and the Torah by Joshua Berman, B-E-R-M-A-N. Okay? Okay? Called Discrepancies Between Laws and the Torah, and it's on page 414 of the title of the book that I just gave you. Now, why is that important? Because he makes one really important point that we can apply immediately to this discussion of the letter to the Romans. And that is this point. What he says is, if we read the text, and he's talking about the Hebrew text, but the same thing applies to Paul. If we read the text and we apply our definition of law, we will make a mistake, because we will anachronistically apply something that we're familiar with in the definition of law that is not part of the ancient world. Okay? And the point is this. We, in modern culture, since at least the 19th century, and probably earlier than that, and I would claim that there are parts of it in the Roman Empire as well, we believe in what we call statutory law. And statutory law is a written code that acts as the foundation for all other subsequent decrees and statutes. And because it is a written code, the system of jurisprudence appeals to that code whenever they need to make a decision. So you might not know the technical terms, but this is exactly how law functions today, right? We have written laws, and judges make decisions based on their interpretation of the written law, but they are not allowed, typically, to go in and rewrite the law, right? The law comes about because of some political legislative process. And once it's in place, like the Constitution of the United States, it's supposed to be the foundation document for everything else. But it's written, okay? And once it's written, it becomes fossilized. It's in stone, right? It doesn't change. You reflect everything accordingly, okay? That is not the way that law worked in the ancient world, right? Yes, you're going to say, yeah, but the Ten Commandments are written. But the difference is that in the ancient world, law is what we call common law. And common law is the set of assumptions of values and ethics that the community embraces because they share the same kind of perspective and the same culture. So I don't need written law because everybody thinks the same way. I only need written law when my when a society is multicultural. And the more multicultural it is, the more written law I need, because now all these different views need to come under one umbrella of legal jurisprudence. Okay? So in the ancient world, most communities were small. Even nation states didn't exist, but city states did. But inside the city, there were common expectations and values, so that the common law, that is, the set of assumptions about how people should behave, never needed to be written down, right? And the point that Berman makes is, if you read the word law in the Tanakh as though it means statutory law, you've imported an idea from the modern world and forced it to fit on top of an ancient culture. If you look at the ancient culture and you read common law, then you get amazing insight. And that is, when Paul talks about tzedekah, when he talks about the Greek word nomos, when he talks about Torah, he's not talking about a fixed set of rigid rules that require everybody to live by them, right? What's he talking about? The common basic assumptions of the Jewish way of life that everybody in the community knows, right? Here's the interesting thing. The common set of Jewish assumptions about basic living is flexible. In other words, it changes according to the situations. It isn't a rigid code, right? And you can see that today, actually, when you realize that one of the functions of a Jewish rabbi is to apply ancient ideas, ancient principles from Torah in modern situations. So you have a Shabbat elevator, which is never talked about in the text, but is an application of an idea in the text. It's flexible. Okay. So this is really important, because when we go to read the book of Romans, Luther, Augustine, Luther, Calvin, the whole Reformation entourage viewed law as a fixed set of regulations, inflexible, which God demanded of his people. So of course they resisted that. They resisted it because it was the imposition of an external requirement on me. That's the way that they saw it, right? And they believed that the Holy Spirit gave them freedom, so they weren't under this imposed external requirement, okay? But if we read, and consequently, they drew a line between law and grace. But if we read law in terms of common understandings of the values and ethical behavior of a community that's embracing the same kind of way of life, then we understand perfectly well when Paul says the law is good and holy and righteous. Then he's not trying to get rid of the law. He doesn't even have the same idea of law that Luther had. His idea of law is whatever those behaviors that are necessary to keep the community in connection with God and being flexible in the process. Right? And once that happens, the law and grace dichotomy goes away completely. It's gone. It doesn't even matter, because it's a misunderstanding of what law actually means. Okay, so when Paul talks about the righteous, tzedekah, and he talks about those people who are in conformity with the ethical and moral standards of the community, he's really talking about the ancient idea of Torah, which is not a cast in stone idea, but it's a summary of the assumptions that go into the believing community that allows me to function in the community. And the assumption behind that is, you and I share the same values. We share the same goals. We share the same relationship with God. We share the same relationship with other people. And that's why we behave like this. But nobody has to write it down. Okay? Do you understand this? This is really, really important, because as Paul begins to develop stuff now, he's going to speak more and more about the relationship to the law. And as he does that, we have to keep telling ourselves he's not talking about statutory law. Okay? Got it? No comments, so we're good. I take that to be a sign of, yes, we understand. Okay, so let's go now. 18. I don't remember. Did we talk about 18? Maybe we did. 18, where he says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." Okay, so take what we just talked about. Remember, we just talked about tzedakah, the idea of righteousness being conformity to the ethical and moral standards of the values of a believing community. And what does Paul say? The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against people who don't conform to the ethical standards and moral expectations of the community of believers. That's all. He's not saying, oh my gosh, God's going to punish every single pagan and send them right straight to hell. No, he's talking about what happens in a community when people don't share the same kind of values. So unrighteousness and ungodliness become exactly the kinds of things where in a multicultural environment like the Roman Empire, people don't share the same values in community. They don't have the same awareness of responsibility and ethics, right? And so Paul's saying, if you're part of the believing community, by the way, you guys in Rome, you are part of the same believing community. Your values, your expectations, the way that you behave should be the same, right? Okay, so my question was, in this verse, the verse is introduced by the Greek conjunctive gar, which we have to have, remember, because he's not saying a new thought. He's saying, as a result of all the stuff we've already talked about, and in particular, as a result of the verse in Habakkuk, which is my foundation verse from the prophets, therefore, and we need to be able to connect the therefore, okay? So, why does Paul use this word? Because he's saying, don't you get it? If you understand the tzedekah by their emunah will live, then you'll understand why God is opposed to those who don't follow the instructions that he gave, okay? Right? So 19. Did you get that? So let's go to 19. And in the NASB, it reads, and by the way, so you can see this is a run-on, right? So he says, 18, for this and this and this and this, and then 19, because of this and this and this and this, and yeah, same idea, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. So here comes 19. What is the reason that Paul says these people are going to be judged? He doesn't say they're going to be judged because they were created human beings with rational thought and they should be able to understand how the functions of the universe work, which is the typical apologetic approach. What is he saying? That the members of a community who share the same values and who are righteous, tzedakah, because of that, right? They are the ones who should know what God expects. How can they miss it? If you're part of the community that reads the Psalms and David says, you know, what is man that you should regard him? I look up at the stars, the sky, that's part of who you are too. You share those same kind of values. So how can you possibly miss this? Right? That's Paul's argument. You members of this community, and ultimately he's going to talk about division and dissension in the community, and basically he starts off by saying, how can you possibly miss the fact that you share the same kind of values to begin with? You're part of this assembly, right? You can't be part of the assembly if you don't even share the same values, so let's start there, okay? So 19, 20. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Okay, so if I'm reading this as a Christian apologist, I'm going to apply this to all the rest of the world, except, of course, me as the believer, or anybody else who's in agreement with me. Okay, so I will say, oh my gosh, God is judging the entire world because they don't believe the way that I believe, right? And Christian apologists usually do that, don't they? They usually say, okay, here's the deal. God created us all. We should recognize that we're not God. The heavens and the earth proclaim his glory. We should recognize the fact that we're not God, and therefore, because we recognize that, it's inherent within our own understanding that some other greater power than us must be responsible for all of this. And therefore, I should humble myself before that greater power and allow God to speak to me. Okay? Of course, that was the argument of the philosophical theologian up until Hume. So Aquinas develops the cosmological argument, Anselm develops the ontological argument. All these arguments for the proof of the existence of God in order to meet Paul's requirement that anybody who is a non-believer should still be able to recognize the God of creation. Okay? And of course, what did we discover? Oh my gosh, have you ever had a discussion with somebody who's a non-believer and try to convince them that there really is a God of creation? Have you ever had that discussion? Do you get anywhere? Does it work? They come to the logical conclusion that, yes, I'm not God and you're not God and nobody that I know is God. Therefore, there must be a God because everything works so well in the universe and it all functions perfectly. And the archer fish can, you know, figure out the angle to shoot the insect outside of the river and all that, you know, all that kind of stuff. Right. Has any argument like that ever convinced anybody that, you know, that there must be a God and I have to serve it? And my answer to that is, after 75 years of doing this, no. I've never met anybody who is intellectually compelled to believe in the God of the Bible. Okay? And I think the reason that we jump on this verse from a Christian apologetics perspective is because we're looking for Paul to argue for a proof for the existence of God. But Paul's not writing to a community that even considers that. The question about whether God exists or not never even occurred to the community that he's writing to, right? They're all part of the Roman assembly of Jewish and non-Jewish believers in Rome. So they're not arguing that point. They don't even consider that point. What are they concerned about? Real simple. How do I live? Right? So what's Paul arguing here? For what he's saying is, don't you get it? Habakkuk tells us that righteousness belongs to those people who commit themselves to this way of life. If you do that, it should be very obvious to you that the God of the heavens is part of the way that you think about the world. And people who don't think that way, people who don't think that way, who are not part of your community, God is unhappy with, right? Because the community is committed to a picture, a paradigm about how the world functions that starts with the sovereignty of God, right? It can't be any other way. It doesn't mean that some pagan is going to be logically argued into believing in God. It means that once you're inside the paradigm, you can't make any other choice. There's no other option for you inside the paradigm, right? Once you commit yourself to this community, once you accept its values, then for you, the only solution to why am I here, what should I do, how should I live, is found in the commitment that you have to God. Okay? So he can say, this should have been easily known to anybody inside the paradigm. And those people who still have a problem with it, there's something wrong with the way that they're thinking about the paradigm, right? They don't have any excuse once they're part of the community, because this is the function, this is the way the community functions. Now, why would Paul even worry about that? Because he has Gentiles who are coming into the community who come with multicultural background. They come from different paradigms. And what he's saying is, when you bring that paradigm into the community, you need to adjust to the way of life that you find in the assembly. And when you adjust that way of life, it changes your perspective on everything. And then once that change occurs, there's no more excuse for you to say, well, I don't happen to believe that. Because if you don't believe that, you obviously don't fit into the paradigm of the community. Right? Okay. So I'm taking it that we're moving forward.
Yeah. Yes. It's so much. I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, it's the same today. If you go from a variety of, I can speak about the ultra-Orthodox and I can personally speak about the ultra-Orthodox and the Haredim, and there's a group of others, and if you don't adhere to their community, you be, you often are, if you can't change, you leave it. And if you really don't believe it, then you're put in what they call harem, which is you're a completely outside the community. You're not even welcome. In the very strict. Don't get, it's not in the mainstream. I'm not in the conservative, but I can actually attest to that. So it's the same thing.
Yeah. But see, I think the mistake that we make is that we think Paul is writing a letter of universal application.
Right.
I mean, we do that to all the apostolic documents. We think these guys are writing for everyone. No, they're not. Paul's writing this letter to a specific group in Rome that had certain kinds of members in it and that had certain kinds of problems that are associated with that. And if there's any better example of believers who come from different perspectives, it would be in Rome. Because as we see when he starts talking about food and idols and all this kind of stuff much later in the letter. Okay. So what he's saying is, listen, if you're part of this community, you start off with the sovereignty of God and your obligation to him and the answer to Heschel's question, what does God demand of me? And on and on and on. And once you do that, there's no excuse for you to go any other direction. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You're going to go in a certain direction and it has to be like that. And if you don't take that direction, then, you know, that's the wrath of God is, you know, it's going to follow you because you're not doing what Habakkuk is talking about. You don't have tzedakah and emunah as part of your paradigm. If you don't have those things, then the rest of this can't possibly apply to you. Okay.
I agree. Really, I'm just saying I understand what I guess I'm saying. I understand what you're
saying. Yeah, yeah.
So the King James says Godhead instead of the divine nature.
What? The King James says what?
Godhead. Even the eternal power and Godhead so that they are without excuse. In the King James.
Yeah, sure, of course. Well, that's got to be, is that in the New King James or the original King James?
No, I think it's, I don't know, I'm on Bible Hub. I think it's New King James.
Yeah, okay, so they basically incorporated a Trinitarian doctrine into the verse, right?
My mistake.
Basically said, okay, we're committed to the Trinitarian doctrine, so every time we see God, we're just going to put in Godhead because that means that there are three persons in one being. They just imported it all, that's all. But that's certainly not what Paul's saying. Yeah.
No, it's the divine nature that should be translated from teotes, the divine nature.
And the problem. Yeah. And so every time we read these things in English, we have to first do the correction for the theological importation that happens. And then we have to do the anachronism, right? Reading it as a modern text instead of an ancient text. And then we have to do the audience correction. Reading it not as a universal text, but as a specific text to a particular audience. And then we have to do the Jewish correction. I mean, it's 1, 2, 3, 4 steps every time. Do this, do this, do this, this. And we finally get back to, oh my gosh, that's really what he was talking about. Then we have to do the exegesis of the vocabulary and the grammar and everything else in order to figure it out. You just can't read it off the top anymore. It's done. Can't read like that anymore. I'm sorry. You're finished, right? You're going to have to start doing all these other steps in order to figure out what's really going on there. Okay. So now that we've got to the point that the people in the community, yes. Who was that? Michael Stanley. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think another important point to remember is back in Paul's day, there were no quote unquote atheists like we have today that didn't believe in a God. Everybody had a God and conformed to that set of rules, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah. And even more importantly, it was a capital offense to be an atheist in the Roman Empire. Right? If you claimed to be an atheist, you were executed. Why? Because a claim to be an atheist offended some god, and no Roman wanted any of the gods to be offended, right? So you're absolutely right. Everybody comes to the picture or to the party with a picture of God. Everybody comes, right? So Paul is dealing with people who come from all over the Roman Empire and are part of this assembly. And what he's saying is, look, the first thing we're going to do is get the paradigm straight. And we're going to start with this verse from a prophet who tells you that this is not about what you think. This is about how you behave. And on that basis, we'll understand what your paradigm is. Because if your paradigm is in connection with tzedakah and emunah, then you're without excuse if you claim any of these other things. Okay? Now, let's go forward. 22. Professing to be wise, they became fools. 22. There's a nuance in the word fools that implies that this life is tasteless and without joy. Do you know anything about the development of the Hebrew idea of fool? There are, I think, three different classifications of fool in the book of Proverbs. But none of them have to do anything with cognitive inability. All right, do you understand? Here's the problem with, this is the anachronism step. If we read this text according to the modern world, we will think Paul's talking about lack of cognitive ability, that some people are stupid because they didn't understand that God was the God of the universe and et cetera, right? They're without excuse and they're stupid. But that's not what he's talking about. Because fool in Hebrew, in all three cases, fool is a moral category, not an intellectual one, right? So there's the fool who just misses the point and with proper instruction will correct his moral behavior, okay? Then there's the fool who deliberately misses the point and doesn't want to be corrected. And then there's the fool, the worst of all, the kasil, who not only knows that he's doing wrong, but instructs other people to do the same thing. Okay? What does Proverbs say? That version of the fool is irredeemable. And basically, Proverbs says, don't even talk to him. There's no chance for that guy. Let him go. What do they say about the in-between guy, the guy who's just doing things wrong because he wants to? It says, okay, well, he still has possibility. There's a chance we can redeem him. So, you know, give it some effort. And then what about the first one? The guy is a fool because he just doesn't get it, right? Ah, well, take all the time that you need and correct the person and bring him into the fold, okay? When Paul uses the word fool here, he is not talking about cognitive inability. He's talking about moral turpitude, okay? What he's saying is, let's think about this. Professing to be wise. So does wise mean cognitive ability? Of course not. Professing to be wise means claiming to be tzedakah, righteous, right? Claiming to do the things that are in alignment with God. These people who have the wrong paradigm base ultimately end up being moral fools. Okay? Got it? Okay. So if that's the case, 23. And remember, there's an and, which means that now the verse continues, the thought continues, and exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of a corruptible man and of the birds and the four-footed beasts and animals and crawling creatures. All right. So he's obviously talking about idolatry in one form or another at the end of that verse. But what does he mean when he says, exchange the glory of the incorruptible God, right, for an image in the form of corruptible man? Okay, before we get to the idolatry part, the birds, the beasts, the crawling creatures, what is the difference between the incorruptible God and corruptible man? What is he really saying? Okay, right? Isn't he saying, we add to the idolatry part, isn't he saying that if I don't adopt the paradigm of the believing community and I continue to act as though I am tzedakah when in fact I am one of the categories of moral fool, I've really made myself God, right? I've exchanged the image of God for me because I'm the one who becomes the judge of my moral behavior, right? It doesn't mean that I am a self-professed idolater. In fact, the people that he's addressing in this community would all say, well, we worship God, the God of Israel. But what he's saying is, if we're looking at Habakkuk, the claim to worship God isn't enough, because what we're looking for is tzedakah, tzedik. We're looking for the people who are conformed to the ethical and moral obligations of the believing community. And they conform themselves, not just once, but over a long period of time, emunah, reliably, constantly, over and over and over. They live out what God expects. Okay? So if that's the case, then those people who claim one thing but live another thing are in fact making themselves God. They're exchanging the character of God, as revealed in the Mosaic Code, for their own version. Okay? It's very practical stuff. It's not cognitive, theological, statement of faith, beliefs. It's very practical stuff. As we see in Habakkuk, it's very practical stuff. It's how I live. All right. So 24, therefore, and by the way, looks to me like we have another conclusion from a previous argument. Therefore, God gave them to the lust of their own hearts, to impurity, to that their bodies might be dishonored among them. These apologies, less moral acts. Oop, what happened here? Slow network connection. Ignore. Okay. Looks like I hope I'm not going to lose you, but it looks like my Italian network is telling me that I'm going to have problems with the network. So if I go away, just stay there and I'll come back as soon as I can. Okay. So let's go to 24 again. Therefore, God gave them over. What did he give them over to? I mean, think about this. He gave them over to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, etc. What a Christian apologist will use this verse to talk about homosexuality, to talk about corruption, to talk about disparaging elders, to talk about all the kinds of things that they can come up with to show you that these people, I just lost it. Are you still there? No. Okay.
I can hear you, Skip, but I can't see you.
Right, we're here.
Okay, the bandwidth is fluctuating. Okay, so did you understand what I'm saying? That the Christian apologist uses this verse to condemn society on the outside of the Christian church. Okay? Because they read this verse as though Paul is writing universally to everyone to tell you how bad society is for all the things that it does. Okay? And of course, part of Paul's statement does apply to the idolatrous world. But for Paul, the idolatrous world was represented in the guy who came out of the cult of Zeus and ends up in the assembly in Rome, right? So as Michael Stanley pointed out, everybody who comes into the assembly came from this background, except proselytes and Jews, right? Everybody else came out of this background. So now Paul is saying, okay, so if you don't participate in the paradigm and you're not interested in what Habakkuk is talking about, then you will make yourself into the God of your own image, right? And condone whatever you're going to condone. And the result is that the same kinds of consequences that occurred in the history of Israel that we have in the prophets will end up in your lap, right? The same kinds of consequences, because you've exchanged God's instructions for your own judgment, right? You will end up, as the rabbis say, the man who determines not to follow God, God allows to happen. Okay? So it doesn't mean that God's encouraging it. It means that God doesn't put his foot down and say, okay, I'm going to stop you right now. He lets it go. Right? And that results, according to Paul, in all this other stuff. It's just the natural consequences of Paul's idea of sin. Right? You know, the Hebrew idea of sin is not the same as the modern idea of sin. First, sin is a religious category, not an ethical one. So it's a violation of a sovereign lawgiver. And second, it already includes the punishment within it, right? In our system of jurisprudence, there's a trial, a verdict, and then the assignment of punishment. But that doesn't happen in Hebrew. In Hebrew, the verdict includes the punishment, right? It's part and parcel with it. So that's why you have the Hebrew idea of measure for measure, right? That's why when the Old Testament or the Tanakh talks about sin, it never has to spell out exactly what the repercussions are, the consequences are for a behavior, because as it says, those things that a man does that he thinks he can get away with will turn back on him, right? It's already built into the process. So when Paul talks about these things are going to happen, he doesn't mean God's going to judge you and then he's going to assign punishment. It's the very fact that you're participating means that the things that are built into the consequences are going to show up. Okay? Actually, we have an aphorism about that. What goes around comes around. Or maybe what comes around goes around. I don't remember which direction the thing goes, but so, same idea. You end up, the dog returns to its vomit. You end up with the same process. Okay? So, let's suppose that that's what Paul has in mind, because that makes sense from the verse in Habakkuk. Okay? So he says, for they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. And my suggestion is that if we really think about that, it'll be the same as saying that they worship themselves because they put themselves in God's position. Now, why would Paul say something like that? Well, it seems to me that if I really think about it, Paul's saying nothing different than what happens in Genesis chapter 3. Right? I mean, think about it. What happens to Adam and the woman as a result of their... First, we have to ask, why do they make the choice? And the choice, of course, they make is to be judges of their own morality. Right? The serpent comes along and says, wait a minute, you got free choice. What's the problem here? Doesn't God give you the option to decide what you want to do? Right? And so they do. And as a result of that, consequences accrue. But they're not consequences that were spelled out. In fact, they aren't even the consequences that were spelled out by God when he says, the day that you shall eat of it, you will surely die. That doesn't even happen. What else happens? A breakdown in relationships, a breakdown with continuity of their own existence, right? Earth and dust, the breakdown of the relationship to the animals, everything that starts falling apart as a natural result of what they do. Why? Because they put themselves in the place of judging their own behavior according to their own standards. And that's exactly what Paul's talking about here. So it seems to me that Paul is simply reflecting on the Jewish idea of what happens in the consequences in Genesis chapter 3 and making it and tipping his hat to Genesis chapter 3 in this letter to the audience, who certainly knew this story because they're part of the assembly of Jewish and Gentile believers in Rome. Right? Okay.
Skip.
Got it?
Skip.
Yes.
I was just going to say, I mean, if I were to not be doing this study and I would just be some, I would go in and read this verse for the exchange, the truth of God for a lie and worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. I mean, it would all be pointing to Satan, like where they say, you know, you're now worshiping Satan. I mean, that's what it sounds like in there for me when you say exchanged, you know, the truth of God for a lie and worship and serve the creature. The creature would be Satan. I mean, that verse, I mean, if you think of it in a religious Christian religion, you know, Satan and hell and all that, that's what comes out to me when I read that like that. That's what it would seem like.
Ah, okay, good. So that just means you have to remove that step with doing the anachronism thing and not read modern theological thought back into Paul's 2,000-year-old letter. That's all. Right, but you're right. You might think of something like that, but now we're going to correct that by saying, wait a minute, Paul's writing to an audience that isn't struggling with, you know, oh my gosh, the devil is after me. He's writing to an audience that's made up of people who've committed to this paradigm, and what he wants to show is that there are issues with your interaction with each other, because we're going to get to that. The whole rest of the letter is about how you interact with each other, right? Okay? But I think that he's relying on their education about what happens in Genesis chapter 3 to see that the same thing is occurring here, right? He's just saying, oh my gosh, didn't you recognize in Genesis chapter 3 what happens to those people is exactly the same thing that I'm talking about here. Does that make sense to you?
The lie would be, what would be the lie that he's talking about?
But what was the lie in Genesis chapter 3? What was the lie that the serpent told the woman? Did he say to you, did God really say that? No, he doesn't. He says, oh, God said that. He agrees, right? God said that. But then he says something. What's the lie? That if you do this, you will be like gods, knowing the difference between good and evil, right? So the lie is you can be your own ethical judge. You don't need to rely on the sovereign God. He gave you free choice. Make up your own mind. That's the lie. It's to determine for yourself what the requirements are for tzedakah, right? Remember Habakkuk says, the righteous, the tzedek, the one who is conformed to the ethical and moral standards of the believing community, and that's the Mosaic Code. That person, because of his constancy, will live. What does Paul say? Ah, these people who thought that they could determine it for themselves end up being, like in Genesis chapter 3, being on the outside because they refused to accept the word of the lawgiver, right, the sovereign, and they thought that they could make up their own mind. Look, what's good for me? And once they did that, they accepted the lie that they could be like God.
So they're the creature would almost be like the Yetzer Hara serving themselves.
Yeah, and serve the creature, right? They served me, right? Yeah. The Yetzer Hara, exactly. They served what I wanted, right? I mean, look what he says. For they exchange the truth of God. What's the truth of God? Well, remember, truth is emunah, right? What is the truth of God? It's conformity to God's, you know, desires for and intentions for man, right? The truth of God is that he's sovereign and he's the one who decides what ethical behavior is. Okay. And they exchange that for the lie. What's the lie? That I can determine for myself, right? And as a result of that, who do they end up worshiping? Well, the question of worship is who do I align my heart with? And in Paul's view, once I give up the notion that God is the one who determines what the demands on my life are, once I give that up, I serve myself. And me, the creature, the created one, becomes my own God. So it isn't necessarily an apologetic against people who worship idols, because the idol is resident right here in this chair, right?
It explains a lot about Christianity today, though, because from Constantine on, we decided to live the way we thought the law or God wanted us to live, and we chose something completely different. So we just, yeah, all through the centuries.
But I don't think it started with Constantine. I mean, I think Paul is writing to an audience in Rome, where Gentiles have come into a Jewish assembly and they bring their paradigm with them. And as you will see later in the letter, they start claiming that because they are under grace, they no longer have to be responsible for those poor, ignorant souls who haven't reached the point where they realize they can eat whatever they want. They've got all that paradigm going on, and Paul has to address that, right? So it's happening right there in that first century assembly, that he's got people with different paradigms all claiming that they're part of the same assembly. And what he's going to do is show that there's a discrepancy in the way that they treat each other, right? And then that reflects on Habakkuk's notion that those who live according to the moral and ethical principles of the way of life that they've adopted should have a different kind of approach. Okay. So
Skip.
Yeah, Tim.
So going back to Genesis 3, knowing good from evil would be the good understanding or knowing good that God is the moral sovereign, evil being man becomes his own moral sovereign.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that I could draw the picture to say, okay, that's how I understand good and evil. Good is whatever God, good is what God determines, right? But I'm not sure evil is only associated with what man determines, right? Gotcha. But it's certainly part of it. And what's interesting is that the serpent's lie is that you will be able on your own to decide that, right? Which is why somebody like Jacques Ellul or Weizenberg basically says, any system of ethics that's created within the human society is essentially anti-God. Any system, even if it's good, even if it has all the right characteristics. Why? Because it didn't come from the sovereign. It was created out of my rational thinking about what makes sense for me. Right? So the serpent's lie can be really subtle. The serpent's lie isn't, oh, you can get away with whatever you want. The serpent's lie is, you see how good you can be? Gee whiz, you can be a noble, wonderful, good person. You don't need God to tell you what's good. You can figure that out on your own. And by the way, that's what all ethical philosophy is about. Coming up with a system of ethics based on rational human understanding. Instead of, in the Jewish world, based on revelation from outside of human understanding. You see the difference? Right?
Hey, Skip.
Yeah.
Yeah, help me out here. Because you're saying that it's Torah, basically, that decides what's good. And yet, you also said that the rabbis continue to, you know, define Torah and making what's good. So aren't they, in effect, doing what, you know, the philosopher does by saying what determines what's good?
No, not at all. Because the difference is this. If the common law of Torah is the basic assumptions that form the foundation for my community, then what the rabbis are doing is showing me how those basic assumptions apply given the circumstances that I'm in, right? So the application of a garment made from two different cloths is very different today than it would have been in the 10th century BC. The application of not boiling a kid in its mother's milk is very different today than it would have been in the 14th century BC, right? But it doesn't mean that I'm saying that I made the principle up myself. What I'm saying is I started with God's revelation and his direction, and now I'm showing you how that fits in the circumstances that I am involved in, right? I'm not saying I created my own ethical system by thinking about what's rational and determining that the rational is the real. Okay? Do you understand?
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks, Skip.
Okay. And I will refer you, if you really, really want to pursue this, I will refer you to the discussion that we had on the book, What Makes the Divine Law So Divine? What was the name of the book? I can't remember now. But we did a discussion on our book. Why is the divine law divine, or what makes the divine law divine, or something like that? It was a couple of book studies ago, and the whole book is about this issue of the fixed written law and the common flexible law. Right? Christine Hayes was the author. Now I can find the book. Oh, I can't find the book because I left it in Florida. Okay. But the study is there. Okay. And Christine Hayes was the author, and it's a long study of how the rabbis deal with this issue of a written inflexible law and a oral flexible law. Okay. And how that differs from the Greek world. Okay. So it's all part of what Paul's talking about here. And why is it so important? Because it helps us understand what kind of community he's addressing. Right? What are the issues that are going on in the community? Okay. So let's go to the next verse. This is verse 24, right? Therefore God gave, no, we did that one. And it's changed the truth. 26. For this reason, 26. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for the women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. Okay, so now here we go. Here comes the big Christian morality lesson and the apologetic against sexual deviancy. We can put it that way, right? 26. One more time, we see that Paul's continuing the logic of his argument with the conjunctive. So notice the argument. It starts in 17. Says, okay, here's the prophet, and now I'm going to tell you, and this, and this, and this, and this, and therefore, and therefore, and therefore, all these arguments strung together to show you that they all go back to his understanding of Habakkuk 2:4. Okay? Now, he says, because of this, because of what? Because of what does he say? So we have to ask, okay, for this reason, what reason was it? What was the reason was that they exchanged God's sovereign understanding of the relationship between human beings for their own understanding. In other words, once they put themselves in the place of becoming the judge and jury over what was ethically correct and what was not ethically correct, then other consequences follow. And according to verse 26, what activity is it that leads directly to the next thought? It's God gave them up. So what he's saying is, God said, it, by the way, it doesn't say that God initiated it. It said that they made the decision to live life according to their own ethical understanding, right? They built a system of ethics based on rational understanding. What's good for me? As a result of that, they abdicated from the revelation outside of human reasoning that says the sovereign God of the universe wants this kind of action. And once they did that, other consequences followed. And one of those consequences, according to Paul in this verse, is that they gave themselves up to degrading passions and their women exchanged natural function for that which is unnatural. Now the question is, what is that? Because Paul doesn't specify what it is, right? Does Paul mean that as a result of them believing the lie that they could create their own ethical system, all the women became lesbians? Is that what he means? I don't think that we can argue that, but we certainly can say there's something unnatural about what's going on here. Okay. And so the question becomes, how do we understand what Paul's talking about? Is the description of sexual actions a synonym but not a result, or a symptom, but not a result? Okay. And I would say, let's back up and remember that if Paul's making reference to the Genesis 3 story, right, that they believed a lie, okay, and that lie was, I can make up my own ethical system, then what does he mean when he says that women gave up their natural function for that which is unnatural? Is he talking about sexual things?
No,
or
I think
he's talking about. Yes, Phyllis.
I think he's talking about what you talk about in your book about women and what their role is.
Yeah, what do you know? Doesn't that make sense? Love, brilliant insight, right? Because
yeah,
think about it. The whole process, Paul's whole process is to show you that these things happen because what? Because you stop, because you switch paradigms. The paradigm that removes you from tzedakah and emunah. What's that paradigm? The paradigm that God revealed in the Mosaic Code to show you what he expects of you. Once you exchange that paradigm for your own rational thought, which is exactly what happened in the Genesis 3 passage, then other things happen. What are those things? Well, one of them is the consequence, as Phyllis points out, one of them is the consequence of the destruction of the natural role that God had in mind for women, right? So you move from relationship manager attuned to what God wants so that you can manage the relationship with your husband in order to achieve God's purposes. You move from that to the end of Genesis and the beginning of the end of Genesis 3 and the beginning of Genesis 4, which is what? The role of the woman now becomes a servant slave of the man. The relationship is all broken. It's scattered all over the place. The children take more precedent than the husband. There's revenge going on. There's all kinds of divorce issues happening. The entire relationship is breaking apart. So does that mean that Paul's saying, oh my gosh, that God gave them up to unnatural sexual attractions? I don't think so. I mean, maybe that's what he's saying, but it seems to me that he's got a much bigger scope in mind. And that bigger scope is, let's go back to Genesis chapter 3 and see what happened to the role of women when we started to believe the lie. And the role of women was drastically altered. Right? What God intended in Genesis chapter 2 was destroyed in Genesis chapter 3. And by the way, been living with it ever since. Okay.
So, Skip, is Paul saying that this is actually what is happening in the Roman church?
No. Okay. So he's constructing the straw man. He does this a lot. Right? He's saying, okay, look, I'm interested in the application of Habakkuk to this community. But if you're not on board, then these kinds of things will happen. Right? You'll make up your own mind about what is ethically correct. And as a result of that, you'll accept the lie that was handed to you in Genesis chapter 3. And as a result of that, your relationships with the rest of the world and other men will break down. And as a result of that, the relationship of women with the role that God intended for them will be destroyed. He's just painting the picture to show you that everything that was already in the Torah is just going to be lived out. So by the paradigm, and follow Tzedakah and Emunah, or be ready for all this stuff. Make sense?
Natural consequences could be applied to that too. If you follow your own rules,
absolutely.
Then you have to deal with what happens there.
Yes. But I think Paul's saying more than natural consequences, see, because what he's saying is, look, if you read this and you're thinking like Paul, and you're thinking about how this connects to the prophets and how it connects to Moses, then it seems to me that what jumps off the page is this is a repetition of Genesis chapter 3. Right? I'm just living this out, and I'm going to see it in the community whenever I depart from the idea that God's revelation through Moses is what I expect in the value system of the community.
Thank you.
And of course, every Gentile believer who comes into the assembly has to deal with this. Every single person, as Michael Stanley points out, every single person who comes into the assembly outside of the Jewish world comes into the assembly with a paradigm that's built on a different kind of God. And every single one will have to deal with this issue. So Paul can use it right up front. And by the way, by the time we get to chapter 2, he doesn't let the Jews off the hook either. Right now he's saying, you guys who were Gentiles who came into the assembly, man, look at what you're facing. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 3 and see how it applies to you. But by the time he gets to Romans chapter 2, he's saying, wait a minute, you thought the Jews were escape this? No, not at all. Right? Okay? Make sense? Comments?
Thank you.
Skip. then what is the wrath of God? We sort of skipped over. What is the wrath of God?
Well, first, it's to allow the natural consequences of sin to occur.
Okay.
And second, at some point, it will be God's intervention to stop the whole thing.
Okay.
Okay.
And that should definitely matter to us.
Yeah. Okay, now we haven't finished with this thought because look, verse 27 says, and, right? So we're going to go down. And by the way, 28 is also and. And the next one, and. Okay. But let's at least try to finish 27. And in the same way, also, man abandoned the natural function of the woman. What was the natural function of the woman, White? Does it mean that men abandoned women sexually so that they could be homosexuals? Well, the first Roman Empire of the first century was rampant with homosexuality. No question about that. But I think if we read this, that they abandoned the natural function of the woman, that we could read it as God intended the woman to be as their connecto. As a result of what happened in the fall, the man refused to allow that function to occur. And as a result of that, all kinds of other disastrous things happened, right? Okay, so, and burned in their desire toward one another. Okay, so now, is this a homosexual passage? Maybe. But what if, and of course, I'll have to investigate some more of this, and we'll talk about it again tomorrow. But what if it means that, because I have to look at the Greek. What if it means that men decided that they're the ones who should be in charge? That's what Adam decides. He decides, I'm going to reject the role of the Ezer Kenegdo in the woman, and I'm going to be in charge. I wonder if I could argue that this verse perhaps is about homosexuality, but that's just another function of a society that's lost its perspective on what God requires. But if maybe it's deeper than that, maybe it's that they all decided that men decided that they're the ones who have to be in charge and they're going to take control of everything. And so burning with desire for one another can mean maybe just that they support each other in that perspective. And they all say, yeah, that's right. Okay. I don't know. We'll have to look at that. Men, with men committing indecent acts and receiving their own persons, the due penalty of their crime, clearly is a homosexual kind of idea. So something else happened in the relationship that God intended between a man and a woman so that it was completely dysfunctional. And in the Roman Empire, that was rampant, was everywhere. Okay. So we're going to stop because I've got to now go and investigate this verse a little bit more. And it's after 3, my time. And you've had plenty to think about. And so now we'll open up if you have any concluding comments before we stop today and come back tomorrow. What do you think?
Skip, can you just tell us again what that PDF download from Academia, the title of it?
Ah, yeah. Yes. The title is, you want the whole book, not just the article. Sorry.
Yeah.
The book is, here it is. The book is The Believer and the Modern Study of the Bible. And the editors. The editors are Tova Gonzel, Yehuda Brandes, and Hayuta Dush. But you'll find it under the title. If you go to the web and you look for The Believer and the Modern Study of the Bible, I'm sure you can find the download.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, Skip, okay. It is available, but not like you said on that academic studies. You got to join or whatever. But if you Google it, it'll come up, libraryoaopen.org. It's free. It's like 600 pages or something.
Yep, that's right. Yep, that's the one. Okay, any other comments? We close and then we come back tomorrow. Yes, good. Okay, ciao then. I'll see you tomorrow.